Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrash, where the Navy Mil Blog community's top bloggers discuss the latest developments, long-term trends, and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team and all things maritime. And welcome to Episode 8 of Midrash, the Valentine's Day edition. I can think of no better antidote for all the saccharin and sugar and required happiness of Valentine's Day than Midrash. So thank you for joining us, whether you are with us live, getting the archive from Blog Talk Radio or downloading the podcast from iTunes. I am your humble host, Fibian, from the blog Commander Salamander, and my co-host today will be the ever-genial Eagle One of EagleSpeak, and if he can find his telephone, we'll have Galran of Information Dissemination coming on as well today. We are returning to the subject of piracy, and we have two guests today I think you're really going to enjoy. Our first has a first guest today has a little special gold star happy face next to his name. He is our first guest from the Dominion of Canada. He is author, journalist, and documentary filmmaker David Sekulich. He's the author of the book Ocean Titans, Journeys in Search of the Soul of a Ship, and you can find that in both hardcover and paperback nowadays. He was also the director of the documentary film Aftermath of War. In his latest book, which has its own website, terroronthesseas.com, is the book cryptically titled Terror on the Seas, True Tales of Modern Day Pirates. And if you're interested in all his work, you can find links to all of them over at my home blog, Commander Salamander. Our second guest today will be former Marine and Special Agent Kevin Dougherty. He is the owner of Nexus Consulting Group of Alexandria, and you may remember Kevin from an interview that I did with him back in November at the USNI blog. After our guests, we'll continue with our usual panel discussion with Eagle One, hopefully Galran, and myself. We'll expand on the discussion we've had on piracy and maybe dwell into some of the other events that have come up this week. While you're listening to the show, I encourage you to join the usual suspects over at our wide-open show chat on the Blog Talk Radio channel page. Eagle One, as always, will ride herd on that. And if you have some questions, kind of feed them in on the board, and Eagle One will do some sifting. We'll try to fold those into the discussion as we go forward. But let's go straight to our first guest of today. Again, author and documentary, David Sekulich. Daniel, welcome to Midrash. And we'll get Daniel on in just a second.
There we are.
Daniel, welcome to Midrash. Sorry about that.
No problem. Thanks for having me, guys. It's great to be here.
Daniel, it's good to have a Canadian accent on the line for a change. All these Southerners here are destroying the Queen's sign language. Just if we get a little cheeky, we'll ask you to pronounce about and roof. But anyway, if you could... Eagle One and myself know a little bit about your background, but if you could, for our readers, could you tell us a little bit about your background as a journalist and author and how you got into documentary films and how you came to focus on the national security area, maritime issues, and with your latest work, piracy?
This goes back to my work as a journalist in the course of the last decade and a half, and I've spent a fair bit of that time in some of the most wonderful places in the world, like Bosnia or Kosovo, even parts of southern Russia. At one point in the course of my work, I became interested in taking a look at nautical issues because of I needed to take a break from all the war. And so I spent some time away from my daily job working on my first book, which is about the lives of those who make their days around designing, building, owning, operating, and even dismantling ocean-going ships. And as interesting as that was, what was more interesting was the stories I kept hearing 7 years ago about piracy from mariners. And that, in turn, led me into wanting to do a much more in-depth look at the issues relating to maritime crime, including piracy. And one of the main reasons that I wanted to do that is because people kept telling me, those who work in the seafaring community, that the scope of the real issue of piracy is far underreported. And as I worked on the book, that came through very, very quickly from even those in positions like the director of the International Maritime Bureau, who said that if you take a look at the official stats, they're not right, that you should take them and double or triple them because of the number of incidents which go unreported. So this takes an issue which is serious to some, perhaps overblown to others, and for me made it into something which is definitely a transnational security threat.
Is one of the points a reader would take away from your work is the fact that what they're reading about the piracy problem is only a small percentage of the actual problem out there, and do you go into how it impacts trade and how that impacts economies and kind of gets a little closer to home for them?
Absolutely. In fact, that's usually what makes most people stand up and pay attention, is the dollars and cents impact of piracy and you know, maritime crime, which it could be costing us, you know, in the course of $50 to $100 billion a year. Those are losses from theft and hostage taking and ransoms, you know, as well as insurance fraud and other related activities. But you know, the dollars and cents is something which is hideous, and yet, ironically, we're seeing lately that the shipping companies who have been relying on the international community to safeguard their vessels are also sort of culpable in the larger scheme of things, because they have been paying much more exorbitant ransoms in the course of the last 3 to 5 years, specifically with Somalia, such that ships which, you know, a few years ago would have been lucky to fetch $50,000 to $75,000 are now, you know, garnering ransoms of $1 to $2 million. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Eagle One.
Yeah, your book, you actually went out and rode with some of the pirates in the Strait of Malacca and then went and talked to a lot of the people in the area around Somalia. Maybe you'd like to talk a little bit about that experience, both in the Strait of Malacca and and your experience meeting with the people in Kenya. And I've got some questions about that.
Yeah, it's some people kind of wondered why I was going to Malaysia on the Strait of Malacca when incidents of piracy there had been on the wane for the last few years. But I went because I'd been told by my research, my land-based research, that there were still attacks going on again. And in fact, they are. And they're going on against people in littoral, in coastal villages, against fishermen. And the impact that they're having on these small communities who make their livelihood from the sea was immense. In one case, a village which had some 32 or 33 fishing boats had seen effectively a third of those vessels stolen just a couple weeks before I arrived there. To most people, that doesn't seem like a big deal. But when it takes you 10 years to save up your money to get a fishing boat, there's no such thing as insurance there. That's having an economic impact on your community, on your family, and on individuals. And it was an example of just how we kind of, oh, well, it's just people in the third world being robbed. But then we go to a place like the Horn of Africa, and we see that it's not only local people who are being affected by piracy, but people in a much, much broader international community. And I'm talking not only of those members of the various international naval forces, which there are about 24 vessels currently on station in the waters off of Eastern Africa, but also all those mariners from around the world who are working through that area. And while it's true that pirates don't attack every single vessel that transits through the Horn of Africa or the Gulf of Aden and waters like that, the threat affects everybody who goes through there. And as I sailed through those waters with merchant mariners, everybody is on edge when you go through there, and it increases an already stressful situation.
Daniel, a couple of weeks ago, Galvin and myself were part of the team at the U.S. Naval Institute's 2010 West Conference in San Diego, and they had a panel on piracy that I may pull a few things from today. But one of the things early on in the discussion was from Rear Admiral McKnight, and one thing he mentioned, which was very peculiar, he touched on the fishing issue as one of the sources for piracy, and of course, piracy for thousands of years is at its core has been at least 51% economic. But he brought up something that I think is one of the undertold stories here, especially if you're an European and you rely on the European press, you just are not getting told what's going on. But this kind of slipped out, and it parallels my experience. As he said, while he was out there, they had 24 ships as part of their anti-piracy patrols, but only three or four of those ships could actually take any type of action against the pirates. Everybody else was just sight and report and showing their flags saying, hey, we're doing something. But again, out of 24 ships, only three or four were really caveat free and that he could fully utilize as a commander afloat. And I wonder if you could comment on that and fold in with it as a Canadian. I know you're very familiar with something that I've only had a chance to read two articles on. And that was a little bit of a controversy with the Canadian Navy, is there was a lot of white space between what was being reported out of Ottawa and what the commander of the ship had to say about how he was able to utilize this helicopter, what he was able to do with pirates and things like that. I wonder if you could flesh that out a little bit for us.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I mean, stepping back, there's always, for anybody who has been involved in the military, and for those who have a bit of an understanding, they know that there is always a political factor in operations. What we have seen in Canada is a bit of from conversations I've had with members of the Canadian military's naval establishment, has been a sense of frustration that a positive spin that it's endlessly being played out by the political masters is not always the reality of the situation that they've been facing, but that it is detrimental to a professional's career if they should happen to go public with something like that. The fact that there is enough sort of frustration that happens to be bubbling up from both the regular sailors as well as officers points to, I think, a much, much, much broader frustration. It's one thing to say that it's, you know, let's deploy more naval vessels, it gives them training, it shows what we're doing, but the sense of having their hands tied in terms of being able to properly carry out the mission is part of a bigger problem, which is something that I have been critical of, I know Eagle as well has been, that simply sending more and more naval assets to areas such as off the Horn of Africa doesn't solve a problem, but it's great optics. It's very easy to deploy a vessel from, for instance, the Canadian East Coast on a six-month mission there. I mean, the chances are that any of those sailors will be injured or killed as they would be in a mission in Afghanistan is minimal. So it looks good, but is it really doing anything? I mean, it is. I don't mean to say we should pull everything away from there, but I have been critical that it's not exactly the best way to do it. And I mean, the fact that we've seen attacks in the Gulf of Aden last year, they were up to about 116, I think it was, compared to about a dozen 2 years earlier. And yet we've had, double the naval presence there. So I think that there's a problem with that. Another thing I might actually bring up too quickly is that while I'm critical of those sort of ability to properly use those naval assets, I'm also even more critical of the reaction of the shipping community, which has done two things. One, it said, okay, you know what, we need to put more barbed wire around our vessels and that. But in fact, as Rear Admiral McKnight pointed out, we're dealing with, and British MOD as well did, you're dealing with maybe a quarter of the vessels going through the Gulf of Aden, for instance, taking the proper precautions. The rest of them are just rolling the dice and gambling with the lives of their crews. I mean, that's just stupid.
Eagle One.
Yeah, I just saw an article from the U.S. Stars and Stripes, which is kind of the unofficial official newspaper of the U.S. military, Daniel. And it talked about private military companies, semi-military companies coming in and as pirate fighters. And one of the let me give you a quote here. Small fast boats with a handful of armed mariners are an emerging way to handle the piracy problems, says an owner of one of the companies. But shipping industry experts frown on the practice. It slightly smacks of vigilantism to me, said Tony Mason, secretary of the International Chamber of Shipping and International Shipping Federation. Is that the kind of approach that should be taken, that they, no shooting, let's not do anything to protect these sailors except pay ransoms for them?
Well, no, I think that ransom shouldn't be paid at all. Let me be adamant about something. I think that the shipping firms and others involved in the shipping industry are culpable, and in some cases governments, by the way, are culpable in making piracy an even more profitable and larger enterprise in Somalia by continually upping the ante and paying more and more money for vessels that shouldn't be. At the same time, I clearly understand the motivation of a shipping company to decide to cash in its insurance bond and pay off for, you know, $1 million or $2 million and get its cargo and, oh yeah, and its crew back. The concern that I have and that a number of others have is the setting up of a two or even three-tiered system. We already know that there are vessels from the United States and other Western or First Nation countries, which have armed guards aboard them, both implicitly and perhaps a little more tacitly. But it's the guys from the Filipinos working on a bulker which is heading from the Mideast to Malta that is getting attacked because they don't take the proper safety measures and they don't have anybody there to protect them. And keep in mind also that even security forces or hands are tied in some places. We had the famous incident of the three from the British Isles security officers who weren't allowed to carry their weapons aboard the vessel and were unable to deter an attack, and all they could do was hide on the up on the Monkey Island of the wheelhouse and then jump into the sea, leaving the crew that they were supposed to protect being taken hostage.
And that was on a large oil tanker, if I recall, that they were unable to do anything about the seizure of it.
Yeah. And you know, it comes back to money. I mean, if you can pay, I seem to recall it was about $50,000 to $75,000 was the cost of getting a first-rate security, private security protection through the Gulf of Aden. That's for, I don't know, 3 to 5 days. You know, a lot of firms aren't willing to pay that. And clearly, as Admiral McKnight pointed out, you know, they're not even willing to take the rest of the measures.
Daniel, would you like to take the caller?
Sorry, say again?
Hey, Daniel, we have one of our longtime listeners on the line has a question for you. Area code 904, do you have a quick question for our guest?
I'd like to hear the speaker's comments about establishing a Navy-sponsored naval armed guard on U.S. flag vessels, including the ships that are chartered and contract operated for MSC and other U.S. government entities.
Okay, good question. Thanks.
It's only a matter of time. It's the short answer to that. The Spaniards are already doing the same thing. They're already doing this right now with their fishing fleets, working out of the Seychelles. Right now you can hire members of the Yemeni Coast Guard who are trained by American forces to be aboard your vessel as a private security or as a security force. It's going to happen. It's actually kind of cheaper instead of deploying another Aegis-class frigate, certainly. So why not send over several dozen people? Because there aren't that many American flag vessels working there. So that's the short answer.
When you're talking about ships, let me throw a little bit of a curveball at you, if you'll let me. Whether you're talking about what their ground forces are doing in Afghanistan or what their Navy does when they join your task group, I think pound for pound, the nation of 5.5 million known as Denmark are always a great ally. And you see a lot of with the hodgepodge of European nations, including the Danes, that are joining the anti-piracy effort. Have you had a chance to look at the different platforms that we see out there from the Arleigh Burkes to some of the U.S. amphibs to the Absalom class. Is there a certain platform that works really well for anti-piracy compared to others?
Well, it's funny you bring up the Absalom because it is proving itself, I think, particularly successful in terms of what it has been able to do, both in terms of its ability to get a return on the investment that the Danish government put into it, as well as its ability to sort of protect vessels from other nations. I was recently talking with a number of naval analysts from both the UK and North America about the idea of trying to provide smaller littoral patrol craft, both for inshore and offshore, and the fact that there aren't enough of those in the seas off of Somalia. That seems to be, you know, one of the issues which is not being addressed, which is we are taking a step back approach. We are waiting out beyond the 12 nautical mile, even the 200 EZ nautical mile limit. And that seems kind of silly. It's kind of like trying to form like a big broad chain and wait for, you know, the bad guys to come out and find us. But the broader, further out you are, the harder it is to actually protect. And if we could increase the force protection measures closer to the coastline, could it potentially have an effect at keeping the pirates from marauding further out? We don't know. We haven't really tried it effectively.
Eagle One.
Yeah, in your book you talked about the we've heard a lot about a defense for the pirates in that their fishing grounds were disturbed by the evil foreign forces, and also there's been illegal dumping off the coast of Somalia. And in your book you mentioned that it was apparently, at least according to the sources you were talking to, some of the warlords were actually entering into contracts to allow fishing by outside sources or dumping of waste by outside sources. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up. For anybody who's listening, I think it's really, really important to understand that there is a myth going around that says that pirates today, in 2010, and 2009 and 2008, the reason they're doing this is because they're some sort of eco-warriors out there defending the Somali people from the predations of illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing that's going on by foreigners and the dumping of toxic waste. It's a myth. It was one of the reasons in the 1990s, absolutely, that people in Somalia, that fishermen and people in coastal communities became angry about the situation. In the wake of the collapse of the government in Somalia, the seas were open. There was nobody there to defend them. There was no Coast Guard, anything like that. And foreign fishing firms realized there was a free-for-all in this bountiful fishery zone there. And they just took advantage of it. And eventually some of the Somali fishermen decided enough was enough and decided to pick up an AK-47 and go out and try and do something about that. But it is not the same anymore. It has changed and evolved into a purely criminal enterprise. And I'm trying to be very emphatic about this because a lot of people lately have been picking up on this bone that somehow the Somali pirates are just Robin Hoods trying to protect themselves. And It's been a myth spun very, very well, I would say, point out, by Somali pirate spokesmen. And gangs have spokesmen out there. And in the summer months during the monsoon, as business was on the wane during the rough seas, these guys managed to get stories out to the press and out to the West that they were just poor fishermen trying to defend themselves. There's two reasons that it's the myth can be proven to be such. One is that you don't go attacking ships carrying food aid from the United Nations World Food Program. They're to feed your own people. You don't attack them and hijack them and interrupt the dispersion of food if you're supposedly safeguarding your own people. And the second is, frankly, these guys have enough weaponry, naval expertise, and manpower that if they really wanted to defend their fisheries from foreign fishing, they could easily do that. But frankly, there's more money to be made hijacking ships and ransoming the cargoes and crews back. And I'm sorry if that sounded like a rant.
hey, we like rants here. Some of us specialize them. That same piracy panel we had over in San Diego, one of the more colorful guest panelists that they had there was Colonel Kaufman, who is the leader of the Marine contingent out there when Rear Admiral McKnight was. And it was a famous opening that had one of the rowdiest audience reactions I think I've ever seen at a professional panel like that, when the panel chair, Dr. Lunsford, asked him, you know, what was the best way to address piracy. He responded in a way that only a 6'5" Marine can. He said, kill the pirates. He kind of said that tongue-in-cheek as being part of it, but later on, when we got a little deeper into the subject, he brought up something that folds in with one of the comments that McKnight said, where it's, you have 23 ships out there, only two or three are actually usable, is that the big problem is that there is no internationally a grand strategy to do it. We have all the tactical tools we need. We have all the operational tools we need, but that the only great barrier to solving this problem, it's at the strategic military and especially the political level, is that there just is no appetite, was the word they kept coming back to. There is no appetite at the political level in the major maritime nations to do what needs to be done to address the piracy issue in a manner which historically it has been dealt with. What do you see that would have to take place for the political level to look down and the strategic military level to give the direction and guidance to the operational and the tactical level to say, do your part? What would be the threshold that would need to be crossed?
That's a really great observation. And you know, I'm going to begin by saying, if the seafaring community can't get its act together in terms of being able to figure out how to cohesively deal with piracy, if only a quarter of their ships are bothering to take the proper measures, check in with the various naval forces and whatnot, if all of them aren't anteing up and coming up to measure, well, if the community that's being attacked can't get its act together, is it any wonder that the governments that are above them can't get their act together, or and by extension their naval forces there? And, you know, the short answer on that one, of course, regarding trying to work together, is that it's not going to happen. I mean, does anybody really expect that you're going to see, People's Republic of China, their naval vessels, and Russia's working together underneath an American admiral? Doesn't seem to me like something we're going to see happening anytime soon. Unless, and here's the big dot, 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 unless a situation happens in Somalia, in the Horn of Africa, where piracy emanates from, that causes enough people's eyes and heads to pay attention. Currently, we are seeing elements of that. I mean, because we haven't paid attention to Somalia, because we've allowed crime to flourish on there and pirates to become emboldened and to make lots of money for militia gangs and the lawlessness to go on, we've also allowed Al-Qaeda to gain a foothold in East Africa. And that wasn't there a few years ago. And by throwing our hands up and wringing our hands and not being able to figure out how to deal with it, we now have a very serious terror threat, which is at its early stages could still be dealt with. But, you know, if we don't pay attention, it could become a big problem in that part of the world.
And Eagle One, I think we have one more question for Daniel. I'll go ahead and give that to you.
What Daniel, do you see in the future, in the near future, say in the next year, for the pirates of Somalia?
Well, I think that we're at a bit of a crisis period, in the sense that after about 3 years of attention being paid by the international community to it, most people's attention is starting to wane, and we're entering that kind of period where people go, throw our arms up. You know, we've tried everything we can. Ships are still getting attacked, they're being paid, well, the heck with it. We may as well just turn our attention to something else. It's a human reaction that comes from getting bored, and maybe it's a bit of the ADD phenomenon, which has enveloped even broader populations. If we don't pay attention to it, it's only going to continue to increase. And similarly, if we don't pay attention to Somalia, we could see a country that is while the southern third, at least, is being controlled by an Islamist group that has allied itself with al-Qaeda, we could see that increase. You could see that spill over into Kenya, into Ethiopia, and we could see it turn into a bigger problem. I don't think that we can wait any longer. I think we have to find a solution that applies to what's happening on the shore. Without doing that, piracy is going to continue to flourish.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. You know, when you talked about ADD that ties into the news cycle, the thing is history and forces with which ill can be very, very jealous and do not like to be ignored. And I think even if there is a desire to ignore it, it's not going to be ignored. It's going to come back. And it's like cancer. It doesn't get better with time or by itself. And Daniel, thank you very much for coming for the first half hour of MidRats today. I think we've really enjoyed the discussion with you, and you've brought a very interesting perspective on the issue of piracy.
Great. Thanks, guys. Great show. Love what you're doing, and hope you keep it up and keep investigating all this stuff.
Thanks
Daniel. And we'll be talking to you down the road. And for everybody that's joining late, that was our guest, Daniel Sakalich. He is the author of two books, Ocean Titans, Journey in Search of the Soul of the Ship. And his latest book is Terror on the Seas, True Tales of Modern Day Pirates. You can find everything you want to know about that book at terrorontheseas.com. And he was also a journalist and a documentary filmmaker. And if you look up Aftermath of War over on Amazon, or you can go to my home blog, you can find a link to his work there as well. And just as a quick reminder to everybody else who's joined us late, you're listening to Navy Mill Blog Radio, MidRats, and I'm your host, Vivian Salamander, along with Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And our second guest today should be familiar to those that follow over at USNI Blog. I did a little interview with him back in November. It is former Marine and Special Agent Kevin Doherty, the owner of Nexus Consulting Group of Alexandria. And Kevin, welcome to MidRats.
Thank you. Afternoon, folks, and thank you for having me.
Great. And you're a little weak on the line, so if you could speak up some, I think that would help us. But while you're doing that, let me just tee up the ball for you here. I think at first blush, I'm familiar, and I know a lot of our listeners are familiar with your work there at the Nexus Consulting Group of Alexandria. And with a background as a Marine and an FBI agent, you bring certain skill sets that seem like a natural fit for what you're doing. But if you could, take a moment to explain how Nexus Consulting Group of Alexandria came to be, what y'all are presently doing right now in the area of maritime security, and what do you see going forward in the springtime season in piracy?
Sure. I was actually a Department of Energy special agent. I was part of the Secretary's detail in the Office of Special Operations. Just wanted to be clear on that aspect. Predominantly, I got involved. Oh, no problem whatsoever. As the son of a retired naval officer and Master Maritime graduate and unrestricted Master Mariner, I've been around the maritime community quite some time. And both my father and brother are mariners out on the seas. And so having the skill set that I had, but understanding the maritime community from the level that I had, I mean, I've saw water in my veins, so to speak. We saw this problem coming. My father was actually involved in a piracy in Trinidad back in 1980 on one of his MSC vessels. So it's not something that's unique. It's not something that has just, you know, the top has just come off of this incident. I mean, this has been going on for a long time. My Marine Corps was born out of it. It will continue to go on. We know, you know, the Straits of Malacca is going to be the next hot spot, more likely than not. And we're seeing West Africa heating up. So with the skill set that I had from a security perspective and the knowledge of the maritime world, I was uniquely positioned to be able to meld the two together and try to come up with our solution to this micro aspect of the piracy in a much more macro world, actually.
Eagle One.
What exactly do you do? What is the most important aspect of what you bring to the anti-piracy table?
Sure. We put armed former Special Operations U.S. Personnel on the U.S. flag vessels, and we provide the deterrence and the ability to respond all the way up to any force exhibited by the pirates. That's the nutshell. We use the escalation of force. As a former special agent, I understand that there's an escalation of force, and our agents and our contractors understand that as well. That it's not we're not there providing lethal force. We're not there providing one type of a show of force. We're providing a full scope of security services that include the ability to mitigate RPGs and AK-47s.
I know you were hearing when we had you on hold beforehand, and I was discussing the panel with Rear Admiral McKnight and Colonel Kaufman. One thing that immediately brought the discussion that we had last year to the fore is Rear Admiral McKnight, when we were discussing how to address piracy, and a couple of the questioners, he's trying to lead him more in the direction that Colonel Kaufman was coming from, but he seemed to have a lot of faith and the effectiveness of nets, speed, and water cannon. If you could please explain the failure history that's been exhibited by these non-lethal means, so to speak, and how you can get yourself in trouble if that's the only tool you have in your toolbox.
We see it. You turn on the TV, and you'll see on Whale Wars how ineffective these LRADs and these water cannons and these nettings. I don't know why people are so afraid to say that when somebody's life is in peril, that it's okay to defend yourself. We learned from the Biscaglia, as we heard earlier in this phone call, that the LRAD that was touted as this great silver bullet to keep the pirates away ended up with those three unarmed security folks jumping off the Biscaglia, literally run off the vessel. And the quote from the owner of that company was, "They laughed at us when we used the LRAD." We can see it. You see it on the Whale Wars when these fire hoses and water hoses are really ineffective against these folks getting close. And you're talking about a distance of at best maybe 100 meters at these cannons. An RPG has a max range at 927. It has a max effective range. At 300 meters, you're going to be dinging with that thing all day. Now you're talking about the issue of putting, you're either going to have to put out a fire or your vessel is going to be damaged to a point where it's potentially, slowing the pace, and or they could have already impregnated the fire hose system that's used that's around it. And I mean, it's a good aspect in the scope of security, but if that's the end result, I mean, in essence, you've conceded, hey, we're going to stop at level 3 or 4 in the use of force, and if it gets to that level 5, we're just going to stop and, in essence, concede the vessel. And really all you've done at this point is upset the pirates as much as any armed security detail would. However, the armed security aspect has that ability to stop it, and we've seen it recently with the Maersk Alabama Round 2, where the security team was able to fire rounds and deter the attack, and we saw it with the Spanish fishing trawler, where the armed response has ceased those attacks.
Eagle One.
Yeah, I asked Daniel, maybe you heard it about, I asked Daniel Sekulich about this some of the controversy over having armed guards on board merchant ships, and I got a quote from the Stars and Stripes about how it strikes some people as vigilantism to have such forces afloat. Obviously, it's your business, but what are the legal ramifications of any kind of armed force out at sea like that?
Well, Eagle One, the question when you asked Danny the question, when I listened in, you were referencing putting vessels in the water, to which I disagree. The premise of being out on the high seas is maintaining that innocent passage. You're out there for recreation. You're out there for commerce. You're out there for legitimate reasons. That vessel is an extension of the United States. It's a United States flag. It follows United States laws. Having the ability to defend yourself against that known threat is akin with what we in the United States do. And as long as we follow those laws that get us to that point. You know, U.S. law covers us during international waters because you revert back to the flag of origin. And as long as we maintain laws of the foreign port state controls, you know, we're within the scope. We're okay. And we've dissected all the laws that we've had to deal with up until the point of international, and then all the laws with the foreign state port controls. And I can tell you, it's doable. It's legal. There's ways to do it. MARAD has stepped up and is assisting with State Department in helping some of these murkier legal issues for some of these foreign port states to say, okay, look, this is how you do it. These are folks who accept it. But, you know, we're following the U.S. law, which gets us all the way out to the end of the international water zones. And it's, you know, the mariners have that right, that innate right to sovereignty in their body, the right to self-defense. And as long as we use, you know, defending from the vessel, we're not out on the high seas, you know, on our own. I know that some security companies have taken that posture. I know Eagle One, I think that was your original question, you know, folks hopping in at vessels on their own and taking up arms. And I'd say that is about as close to vigilantism as you can be. Our guys are on the ships, they're on a U.S. flag, they're U.S. citizens, and they're there in defensive postures. I think that's well within the scope. And you know, I've heard some analogies that I like. It's a lot like here in the United States that a private entity, a bank, you know, has private security that protect their interests there. And you know, if we go back to the fact that that's a U.S. vessel under U.S. laws, engaged in legal innocent passage commerce, you know, they have that right to not say, hey, it's okay for you folks to shoot RPGs at us and put our life in danger. So I think that within that scope, I know I feel very comfortable with it.
Going back to McKnight's 24 ships, of which only 3 or 4 are relatively caveat-free in what they could do, when your teams are out there, I have 2 questions for you. One, in addition to what the ship have themselves, do y'all bring any communications equipment that gives you an over-the-horizon capability to communicate with the international anti-piracy fleet that is out there? And also, do you have the ability to communicate with all of those ships in an effective, over-the-horizon manner? And if you could, are there some nations whose ships may be less likely to want to come to your assistance if you have lethal force being used against pirates?
So, as far as the communication line, unfortunately, as fragmented as the combined task force is, as mentioned, you know, with 16 vessels, 3 or 4 are only effective. We're seeing that with the command as well. Early on, you know, on one of my first transits back in May, I mean, there were 12 different entities that you were reporting to and that were giving information. And since then, it looks like UKMTO has stepped up and sort of taken the lead in it. But there's still certainly other folks involved. But there still truly isn't a seamless direct contact. Hey, I'm in trouble and I need your help. And, you know, I know that you're the closest vessel and be able to go. I had a chance to talk to Admiral McKnight 2 weeks ago here in D.C. And my understanding, he said now the response time is roughly 20 minutes. They hope under ideal conditions in the Gulf of Aden Lane that if you have properly reported your vessel to the UKMTO and followed the chart that you're supposed to, that they can get to you in that time. And from what I've seen, when responses are needed in minutes, the navies, unfortunately, are still taking hours to get there, and there absolutely is a fragmented communication system. There's a lot of different layers who you report to and who then issues the response. As far as the second part of the question, do I think that countries will be less likely. Thus far, I don't know, to be honest. I haven't seen it. I know there was apprehension. I definitely know that from time to time we have some helicopters that will come over our heads and check us out. We show up, we'll raise our American flag, and they'll see who we are. I'd like to say no. I'd like to say that these folks will respond appropriately as needed. If there was a lacking in response, I would hope it would be because they'd say, hey, with this armed security detail, they may not need as much naval assets allocated to them. But thus far, I haven't seen that. And to be honest, we haven't needed it thus far.
Eagle One.
Yeah, I'm looking at some of the comments in our chat room, and there is some discussion of the use of Q-ships. I'm sure you're familiar with those, the merchants carrying arms masquerading as regular vessels. To
right.
a certain extent, is the armed carrying of armed personnel to defend the ship, isn't that automatically kind of qualify as a Q-ship sort of role?
I say no. The Q-ships, we go back to intent. The Q-ships were out there for that. You know, they were out there for the reason of, you know, of drawing these folks out. Their intent, they're out there for the issue of, we're out there in a defensive role. That ship has a mission of commerce to get our U.S. cargo. More often than not, it's government cargo that the vessels that we're dealing with are, and to get it from point A to point B. We're there not to draw the pirates into a fight, not to draw them out, not to have anything other than to be a responsive force to any threat or use of force by pirates at that out in those specific waters that we're operating in. There's no masquerade. There's not any. We don't put any tarps on anything. And as the folks come up, we pull them off and sucker them in, or anything along those lines. We're very overt in who we are, what we're doing, and you know, we are there in a defensive role in case.
I know this is a little out of your lane, but let me give you a chance to take out a magic wand. When you look at it from a military perspective here, is it's really obvious if you want to define the pirates as the enemy, which in a mercantile republic you should, the enemy is a lot more agile than we are, even on national level. And it's very difficult to argue that one of the largest parts of our problem is there is a wall between AFRICOM, which has the land side of the house, and U.S. CENTCOM, i.e. Fifth Fleet, which owns the water, and to try to – the dysfunction that takes place there at the four-star level is – it would be comical if it wasn't embarrassing and sad. And you multiply that to an international level, and I think that's where you get away from the spin of, if you follow my top 10 rules and we'll be there in 20 minutes, but that only applies to 2% of the ships. The other 98% are out there sucking eggs for a few hours.
Right.
If you could take out your magic wand and shake it over the Horn of Africa area, what type of construct do you see would be not only just effective but economically feasible? You can't do a convoy system where you say, okay, you Group 3 cargo ship, you wait here for 4 days for the other ships to show up. That's just not economically feasible. What could happen if you could snap your fingers that could at least – initially get a little better hold of the system?
Well, I think this is where Admiral McKnight's net comes into play. And I think it's a more of a conceptual net than an actual net. But the waters that are safe around the world are there because there's a hierarchy, there's a layered system, there's a coast to all the way out to the naval forces continuum. You've got security on land, you've got security in the coastal waters, and then in the international waters you've got forces as well. And I agree with what Daniel's saying, that there absolutely needs to be security on the lands. Shy of that, you know, the coastal waters need to be regulated. And it's a two-way regulation. It's regulations for folks entering the water who may or may not be engaging in dumping or illegal fishing, and it's regulations going out of the water. But I think that's where this net concept comes into play. I think wrapping it around a ship absolutely doesn't, but a conceptual net, just as most countries have, protecting the sovereignty of their land and their waters, is absolutely what's needed. And if I had one fell swoop of a wand, it would absolutely be to establish an effective two-way coast guard off those coastal waters. Side note also, if I may, the convoy issue is a funny issue, because back here in the United States, when I hear about it, people tout it as being this effective tool that's going on in the Gulf. But what actually ends up happening, and I've been out there a couple of times, is three things tend to happen. One, and as you mentioned, Commander, you know, sometimes you've got to wait a couple of days to get your particular convoy lined up. And what they're doing is they're keying it off of the speed of the vessel. So if you've got a vessel that goes 14 knots, you know, maybe 10 a.m. is where the 14-knot vessels go. Well, what tends to happen is maybe five or six vessels show up for that convoy, which are almost always un-Navy supported. Three of those ships can do more than 14 knots because they revert back to the, you know, the lion chasing a pack of people. Hey, you just don't want to be the slowest person. And then one or two of those vessels tend to be a little bit slower, but think maybe we can keep up if we operate at 105%. We've got a group, and maybe they'll slow down for us. And literally by day one, that convoy concept has gone back to, hey, we're out here on our own. So it plays well back here, but when the water hits the bow, you know, as in the rubber hitting the road, the convoys just don't work.
Yeah, it's funny. You look at the history of convoy operations. You can go all the way back to the Napoleonic era, when you had the East Indies fleet meeting up with the Orient fleet, trying to get through the Indian Ocean against the French. Same challenge is experienced right there. But you can only really solve it if all your ships are from the same nation and you have the power of law to enforce it. And it's kind of untenable to a large extent to expect that to hold together. Because you're right, the Serengeti laws take place. You don't have to be real fast. You just got to be faster than those three Liberian flag guys that can't make more than 15 knots. And you've got it made in your convoy. Hey, let me toss it over to Eagle One here for a second, see if he has a question for you.
Well, same along those lines, you're talking about influencing the matters ashore, and I think Daniel addressed that, and I know that certainly on my blog I've addressed it, and I think pretty much everybody that's looked at the problem has addressed it. But since nobody seems willing to invade Somalia tomorrow to solve this issue, how's it look to you to have some kind of market time or blockade of the ports we know the pirates are operating out of?
You know, unfortunately, that will work. There will be a metric to be able to measure and say, look, we're doing something. The problem, though, is, in my opinion, this is a four quadrants attack by these pirates. You've got with that in mind, calling the Gulf of Aden sort of the central response. You've still got, in my opinion, I have no tangible data, but other from what I've seen from our folks reporting how the vessels are hitting, I'm fairly certain that a lot of the vessels are born out of Yemen, probably Somali pirates, but still supported either from the Yemen coastline and or off of the Yemen coastline, I think with direct ties to some of the terrorist organizations up there. We've seen attacks that have happened out in Amman, and these skiffs just aren't going to be supported from Somalia. And we've also seen over by the Seychelles a great deal of attacks that are probably born out of the motherships. So in setting that up off of the coast of Somalia, we're still only affecting one particular quadrant of this sort of four-pronged attack by the pirates. Will it get results? Absolutely. With that in mind, we might only see 25% of the total effectiveness as opposed to sort of a comprehensive approach. And truth be told, I don't know what the comprehensive approach would be. You know, I revert back to the admiral from the EU who said, look, that's a million square miles or million nautical miles, and we're just not going to be able to effectively patrol it. You know, Eagle One, I don't know if that made sense or not.
No, it makes sense. I think many of us are just frustrated that, you know, we can't seem to solve the problem at sea, and that if containment is the issue, then you have to move the containment closer to their shore and diminish the size of that square mileage that the navies need to cover. You know, you can't protect the entire Indian Ocean or the entire Gulf of Aden, but you sure looks to me, if you had enough vessels, you could protect a chunk just off the near coastal waters of Somalia.
Absolutely. And like I said, you'd see a couple of things. One, you'd see effective results. Not across the board. It wouldn't be the silver bullet, but you would see a result. You'd also see a migration, and that migration would be indicative of yet, you know, a response. Okay, now we're seeing a migration. The attacks are happening here. We may be able to start targeting trends and really then be able to solve the issue. I think I would much rather someone start peeling some layer of the onion back, as opposed to people just saying, okay, we recognize there's an onion here and it's on the table and it's starting to really smell, but you know, nobody's really addressing the stopping of it. You know, another interesting fact, and I don't know if David brought it up earlier, but you know, with Admiral McKnight mentioning that, you know, 18 vessels that he had at his disposal, and of that only two or three were effective. You know, some of those that are even being effective, their response is this catch and release program where they catch these pirates, they give them this blue UN bag that's full of food, water, everything they need, and you know, maybe they have weapons on them, they break them down, you know, but they catch them, they release them, they give them more, in essence, encourage. And as we see in New York with this gentleman who's being charged, you know, we're talking about multiple different attacks, and you know, it's not, we are definitely, whether directly or indirectly, you know, assisting the piracy, I think, ourselves. You know, our Navy's catch and release program is just, on the two or three vessels that we have, with them catching and releasing these pirates, that's certainly not going to put any kind of dent or any issue to solve, and I think only encourages.
Yeah, you mentioned the blue UN bags and the water. I believe I read about that first in the article that I mentioned to Daniel that came out a couple months ago, I believe, about the Canadian frigates' experience out there, that's exactly what they're doing. They catch the pirates, they make sure they're well hydrated and they have enough to eat, and they know, you know, what their vector is back to the coast. I mean, they do everything but give them condoms for HIV protection. They send them on their way. When you're talking about comprehensive approach, I think one of the more interesting ideas, and again, you run into the lowest common denominator from the political standpoint, is when people look at a map of Somalia, they see this country that was welded together from former British and Italian Somaliland. And the reality on the ground is you actually have three major pieces and probably some more if you want, depending upon what fidelity you wanted to go down to. You have Somaliland, you have Puntland, and then you have Somalia around Mogadishu in the north. And that's just on top of the usual tribal issues.
Right.
Do you see as part of the solution here is perhaps leveraging the desire of Somaliland and Puntland to be able to cut off, go their own way, and join the community of nations?
You know, it's there's a yes and there's a no, and this is a much higher level than where I'm at. We Nexus, my company, have actually been solicited. We are working with some folks here in the United States who are of Somali descent, and the land of Somalia really seems to only exist in UN documentation. You know, Somalis revert back to their tribe, their clan. They want to have this unified entity, but when I'm educated on it, they revert back to the fact that it's Ethiopia and it's Kenya and it's some of these other AU entities that are maintaining this Somalia for their particular reasons. And again, this is a political discussion that's probably much higher than you know, in my old government talk, my pay grade. But in hearing this from Somalis, it's certainly very interesting to me. I do think, you know, I know that the Somaliland is trying to stand up a Coast Guard and they're attempting to have some effect. They're, you know, and again, this is more of a crystal ball than anything else, but I do think that any catalyst to have an entity say, hey, I want to go forth as this entity and do it ourselves and step up and make the step has got, I mean, there's energy there. There's the desire to do something, to stand alone and, or to stand at the very least. And if that's something that can affect stability, then I'd say it's a good thing. From a much more macro, diplomatic sense, I don't know. I know there's a lot of forces that are being worked there. I know Somaliland is trying hard to stand up their Coast Guard and affect results. I know there are a lot of factors that are there, as are anytime you have tribal entities and you draw lines that are arbitrary that run right through these tribal lands. There's a much larger issue that's in play. So, you know, we talk about Somalia, we talk about it here in the United States, and it's easy because it's a country with lands, and we can define it. We can look on Wikipedia and see that it looks like this nice seven, but you know, the Somali themselves don't necessarily see it that way. So if they can figure a way to rule themselves and to stand and to be effective, you know, I would certainly be for that, for some sort of stability.
And Kevin, I think that's about it for today. I think we could go for hours. And again, our last guest on MidRats was Kevin Doherty, the owner of Nexus Consulting Group of Alexandria. Kevin, thanks for coming on, and look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you all. You guys are doing a great job, and I very much appreciate the fact
people are talking about it,
and that we're trying to be as transparent as possible. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you,
Kevin.
Good
day, Kevin.
Yo ho, yo ho, a pirate's life for me. We pillage, we plunder, we rifle and loot. Drink up, me hearties, yo ho. We kidnap and ravage and don't give a hoot. Drink up, me hearties, yo ho. Yo ho, yo ho, a pirate's life for me. We extort, we pilfer, we filch and sack. Drink up, me hearties, yo ho. Maraud and embezzle and even hijack. Drink up, me hearties, yo ho. Yo ho, yo ho, a pirate's life for me. We kindle and charge.